everybody. Hello. We're here for a very special show today, culminating the conference, unless you consider the business meeting to be culminating the conference, which I don't. I want you to know that during Michael's introduction, but especially during the performance that's going to follow it, feel free to react. Actors like to see reactions from the audience, and you don't have to sit still in awe here. Not that the ARSC audience has ever done that for anybody, certainly not for me. But feel free to express your appreciation. I'll turn it over now to Dr. Michael Beal.
This has been a very exciting day for me. I finally had a chance to meet one of my all-time idols, Norman Corwin. And this afternoon, you will also. At the age of 101, Norman feels more comfortable meeting and greeting on a one-by-one basis rather than speaking in front of a large crowd. So my yesterday USA partner, Walden Hughes, and I will first give you an introduction to Norman Corwin, and then you'll have the experience of a recreation of one of his classic productions from 1945. And after that, we'll have a meet and greet outside if you have autographs and stuff. Most of you in ARSC know me mainly in my guise as a record collector, but in real life, I was a professor of radio TV, teaching mainly audio production, broadcasting history, and broadcasting's role in society. I've often said that I was in the last generation who was actually trained in the art of radio drama, which was rapidly disappearing in my college years of the 1960s. But under the tutelage of Dr. Delwyn B. Dusenberry, we produced scores of radio drama. And I found that many of them had been written by a Norman Corwin. Temple University had a room full of scripts for us to choose from for our projects. And I can't begin to tell you how many productions I was in and things like My Client Curly, The Odyssey of Runyon Jones, Murder in Studio One, Mary and the Fairy, the ironic Seems Radio Is Here to Stay, They Fly Through the Air with the Greatest of Ease, and Norman's first major CBS script, the ultra-poetic The Plot to Overthrow Christmas.
It began with the line, have you heard about The Plot to Overthrow Christmas? Well, gather ye now from Maine to the Isthmus of Panama,
and listen to the story of the utter inglory of some glory goings-on in hell. Now, it happened in Hades, ladies and gentlemen. It happened in hell that the fiends held a meeting. The fiends held a meeting for the purpose of defeating Christmas. As I was saying, in this Stygian grot, the notables of Hades hatched a plot. And what went on in that sulfurous hole, we'll soon pick up by remote control. Of course, such a pickup is not made quickly. As a matter of fact, it's done rather trickily. You mustn't mind if it sounds erratic.
That's merely intraterrestrial static. Don't be surprised if you're deafened by thunder, just as we start on our journey under.
Sir, if you please, my apologies. I would not have intruded upon your recital if the matter were not so terribly vital.
The most important matter in the world is piddling when it comes to be compared to Nero's fiddling.
And now what you say may be very true, but I have been sent here to summon you to a great mass meeting of tortured souls down in the grot of the flaming coals.
A meeting? What for? What's the big idea? Why can't a fella have some peace down here? Why are we meeting? Who's on the spot?
We're meeting in order to fabricate a plot. A plot against the festival that mortal men can comfort in and gladden in again and again.
I say that we should all give pause to think about this Santa Claus. He is the man behind the scenes, the symbol of what Christmas means. If we could rub him out, old friend, our troubles would be at an end. Just think how it would tickle us to liquidate St. Nicholas.
There was something different about a Norman Corwin script from any of the others that we did. Now, mind you, when I was in college, we were producing these without the guidance of being able to hear the original recordings like we can now. OTR, old-time radio, collecting, was only just beginning back then, and none of these programs were in circulation. But the use of words, the rhymes, where it would be unexpected in what was usually a world of prose, and a social justice bite under the surface, all of these set a Norman Corwin script apart from the rest. Indeed, it was poetry which brought him into radio in the first place. First with Rhymes and Cadences at WBZA, WBZA, Springfield, Boston, in 1932, and after a stint at WLW in 36, at John V.L. Hoken's landmark high-fidelity station, W2, later WQXR, where his innovative program, Poetic License, caught the ear of William B. Lewis at CBS.
Sea Fever by John Masefield. I must down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and the sky, and all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by, and the wheel's kick and the wind's song and the white sails shaking and a gray mist on the sea's face and a gray dawn breaking. Boots by Rudyard Kipling. Where foot slog, 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 slogging over Africa. Try to think of something different. Oh, my God, keep me from going lunatic. Boots, 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 moving up and down again. There's no discharge in the war. Count, 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 count the bullets in the bandoliers. If your eyes drop, they will get atop of you. I have marched 6 weeks in hell and certify it is not fire, devil's dark, or anything but boots, 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 moving up and down again, and there's no discharge in the war.
I'll admit to a bit of cheating here. No recordings of his pre-CBS broadcast are available. There might be a poetic license at Belfer Labs. But Norman later recorded an album of poetry readings for the educational series of Columbia Records, and I stole this bit from it. Now, mind you, Norman does not like this album.
Wasn't I the performer on that?
That's exactly it. Yeah.
What will you charge to forget that?
What is interesting is there were three other albums in that series later on.
Yeah.
And I want you to know now what company you were in as a poetry reader. The other three albums were done by Basil Rathbone, Edith Evans, and John Gielgud.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So that is an interesting set of four albums there, and yours is the first of the four.
I just got a promotion. I did not think I did too good a job on that, and that's why a moment ago I said, you know, how much would you charge not to forget this? But I'm willing to be talked out of that position. But I'd have to hear it again. I haven't heard it. I've never been enchanted by my performance at the microphone.
I will get you a copy of the set, Norman, I will. Norman is sitting over there in the front row, by the way. I think that... Upon arrival at CBS, despite having prior radio experience at the microphone, he underwent a process of training on how to produce and direct programs the CBS way, just like I was trained in college 30 years later. There were no college courses in radio production back then. The networks molded you. And CBS was the place to be for innovative, if non-commercial, programming. They had already produced a landmark program written by Archibald MacLeish, Fall of the City, which was so big it had to be produced at the 7th Regiment Armory, not a studio. It was part of a series designed to be innovated called the Columbia Workshop. Yes, these were non-commercial programs, sustaining they were called. The network produced them because they wanted to produce them, not because some commercial advertiser wanted to sell soap, laxative, or cigarettes. After several months of directing programs like Gilbert Seldes' Living History, and a number of Columbia workshops, Corwin started writing and directing a series of workshops, Words Without Music, the first being The Plot to Overthrow Christmas, and the next being a protest against fascist bombing civilians. They fly through the air. That's the social bite. More dramatic poetic series would follow, such as the backbreaking 26 by Corwin. 26 dramas in 26 grueling weeks. But like Irving Berlin wrote, as the storm clouds gather far across the sea, Corwin also set out to pledge allegiance to a land that's free. In an edition of The Pursuit of Happiness, he produced Paul Robertson in Earl Robinson's cantata, which he had renamed Ballad for Americans. Both my sister and I were taught this work when we were in fifth grade in the mid-1950s, and I bet I could still phone her and just say, in 76 the sky was red, and she would reply, thunder rumbling overhead. It was a turning point in my interest in the media, but it was also the era of blacklisting, and we didn't understand why we were unable to purchase Paul Robeson's recording on RCA Victor and had to settle for Bing Crosby's on Decca. On December 7, 1941, Norman was on a train traveling from Washington, D.C. to here in L.A., where he was to produce the following week what I feel is the greatest work of radio's golden age, We Hold These Truths. That night, December 7th, the Gulf Screen Guild Playhouse was presenting a repeat of his play Between Americans, which had originally aired in July on the Columbia Presents Corwin series with Ray Collins in the main role. When he asked the porter to rent him a radio so he could listen to the broadcast, he first learned then about the attack earlier that day on Pearl Harbor. Between Americans is itself a stirring patriotic statement, only coincidentally broadcast on the day that will live in infamy. After many hours of commercial-free news bulletin broadcasts, this program was the first to return to the regular schedule, mainly because it was so appropriate. But remember, Norman was trapped on a train 1,000 miles away from the studio, and Gulf could not resist including their commercials as usual. Here in a much edited version.
Between Americans, starring Orson Welles.
The Gulf Screen Guild Theater, the Gulf Oil Companies, and your good Gulf dealer are proud to present a dramatic picture of this, our America. Here is your host, Roger Pryor, to tell you about it.
Good evening, everyone. We welcome you tonight to one of the most timely programs ever heard on the Gulf Screen Guild Theater, our production of Norman Corwin's script, Between Americans, starring Orson Welles. Broadcast at any time, we believe this program would make every American's heart beat a little faster, make him hold his head just a little higher. But since the tragic and foreboding news that came today, this program, Between Americans, now becomes an American odyssey. In just a moment, our story will begin. But first, here's Bud Heaston.
Right. And here's an easy way to change from a pessimist into an optimist. If you're wondering now how long you may have to keep your present car, and wondering, too, if it will last, if it will stay in good condition, just look on the bright side of the picture. Remember, when you give the wearing parts of your car good protection, that helps it stay young and act young a long, long time. So give your automobile the modern method of lubrication. Get Gulflex registered lubrication, a much better than usual grease job at no extra cost. Remember, too, that your good Gulf dealer is also ready with splendid motor oils and gasolines, such as Gulf No-Nox gasoline. Make it a habit to stop regularly at your neighborhood good Gulf dealers, your headquarters for making your car last longer.
And now, Oscar Bradley's music introduces Orson Welles, who will talk Between Americans.
Now, tonight, we're doing something quite foreign to the type of thing usually presented by the Gulf Screen Guild Theater. Instead of telling a story about five or six people, we're telling a story about 100 million. This happens to include you, listener, whatever your name may be. As a matter of fact, names don't bother real Americans very much. Not when we've got states named after French kings and English queens are lifted right out of the Latin language like Montana, or out of the Spanish like Nevada. You know, if you were to hold a convention of all the people who live in foreign-sounding American towns, we could fill quite a sizable stadium. Among the delegates registering on the first day would be...
Me, I'm the delegate from London, Minnesota.
I'm in from Dublin, New Hampshire.
Flew in this morning from Cairo, Illinois.
Huh? Whose turn, me? I'm from Canton, Connecticut.
I'm from Paris, Texas.
I came all the way from Shanghai, West Virginia.
Walsall, Georgia.
I'm the delegate representing Moscow, Kentucky.
Hitchhiked here from Baghdad, Florida.
All right, delegates, now that you've registered, you may all be seated. Now, that's all the preliminaries there's going to be tonight. We're through with the introductions, the overture, and the official registration. So now we can get down to the text, which is roughly speaking this. Today, particularly, people are thinking about their country pretty hard. Some of them for the first time in their lives. People are wondering where we're headed. Men are being called on to get ready to defend America. A lot of them are thinking in terms of what is there to defend. Well, now, America means a lot of things to a lot of people. Most of them are solid patriots, only they don't know it. They don't have to wear a red and white and blue button in their lapels to prove it. They don't have to agree with or even listen to people like this.
My fellow citizens, in this great state of blood and plethora, we can...
There were only two words that had to be changed or added to that script, today particularly. Everything else about people thinking for the first time about that country was what Norman had written about in the production when it was played in July of 41. Hours earlier, Norman had wired Washington from the train to find out if they still wanted to go ahead with We Hold These Truths the following week. It is of even greater importance now than before, was the reply. It was a landmark all-star gala commemoration of the 150th anniversary of the signing of the Bill of Rights. It was the first program of its kind to be broadcast on all four networks, sustaining, without commercials, of course. And it was even carried on some of the small, of the few independent stations that are on the air post-sunset at that time. You could practically listen to nothing else. But who would want to? The program was so important that the recording was distributed to schools nationwide by an education department. Unfortunately, it's a very dull-sounding dub. And it seems to me to be the source of most of the circulating copies. When I got a copy of the album recently, that's what it sounded like. But fortunately, when I was in grad school and just heard about the program, but had never heard it, a friend of mine got me a tape right off the original 16-inch CBS radio recorder's masters, including the CBS opening and closing announcements, not on the circulating copies.
Instead of the Lady Esther program with Orson Welles, you will hear a broadcast commemorating the 150th anniversary of the signing of the Bill of Rights. For this program, the President of the United States will speak from the White House in Washington, D.C., Leopold Stokowski will be heard from New York City, and here in Hollywood, Norman Corwin will present a drama written especially for this great American occasion.
We hold these truths.
This is a program about the making of a promise and the keeping of a promise. This is a program about the rights of people. This is a program coming to you over the combined radio networks of the United States, bringing you the voices of Americans, bringing you the voice of the President of the United States. This is a program for listeners in all zones of continental time, for listeners on ships away from home, for listeners in uniform, for listeners on the American islands in the two great oceans. This is a program about the guarantee made to the people of America 150 years ago, a guarantee that has been kept through peace and war and peace and war. A guarantee we call the Bill of Rights.
My name is Barrymore. I am one of several actors gathered in a studio in California near shores that face an enemy across an ocean now Pacific in name only.
...150 years is a twinkle to a star, but to a man it's time enough to teach six generations what the meaning is of liberty, how to use it, when to fight for it.
Have you ever been to Washington, your capital? Been there lately? Well, let me tell you, it's a place of buildings and of boom and bustle, of the fever of emergency, of workers working overtime, of windows lighted late into the night. It's a handsome city, proud of its sturdy name, proud of the men who stopped there and made decisions, proud of its domes and lawns and monuments. Of course, Washington is like some other cities you've seen. It has streetcars, haberdasheries, newsstands, coffee shops, and slums. At busy intersections, there are neon traffic signs which, when the light's against you, say, "Don't walk." And when the light changes, "Walk." It's a tourist city, which is proper when you think how much of history a busy guide can cover in a day. The tourists go to see the sights they've seen a thousand pictures of, sights so famous and familiar that they're thrilled to find they look, well, they look just like they thought they'd look.
Now, isn't that exactly what all of you have felt the first time you ever were in Washington? I've wanted to ask this question for 40 years. And what I asked Norman a little earlier this afternoon was, Jimmy Stewart supposed to chuckle at the "don't walk" line? And he told me, no, that was one of the two mistakes in the program. And I've been telling Norman, don't obsess over those two little errors. Every time we talk about, anybody talks about this program, he always brings up that Jimmy didn't get back to the microphone. And I tell him, it's such a great show. Yeah, I can edit out that little mistake. But Norman had spent a full month researching the program, the subject, at the Library of Congress. And I thought that I was a pretty good student of history, but I learned more about the history of the Constitution and how it was greeted by the country in this one scene than all of my history classes.
Well, now that's fine.
So the Constitution has been drafted, signed, and presently will be submitted to the states for their approval. Now the convention is all relaxed now. There are handshakes, felicitations. Is everybody happy? Will they celebrate, do you suppose? Will Rufus King go home to Boston and be welcomed by a welcoming committee from the city? Will appreciative Virginians hoist James Madison on their shoulders and parade him through the streets, shouting, "Father of the Constitution"? Will a thumping band march up and down the town making a noise like this? No, there will be no band. There will be no speeches. There will be no celebration. No confetti from the windows. Fireworks saluting cannon. Roses strewn beneath the coaches of the delegates. Instead, suspicion. Suspicion by the very men who fought the long fight so that there could be a constitution drawn for the emancipated states. The farmers and the clerks and the hackmen and the artisans and the grease-grimed blacksmiths in their shops. These men who only lately put away their guns and powder in a good dry place. These men who won a war of freedom, but who know that freedom must be guarded to be kept. And they're suspicious. And they're talking in the common, in the tavern, and in the parlor, and in the foundry room.
All right, what else does it say?
Well, that covers it. That's the whole thing.
Constitution. I don't like it.
Why?
Come here with me. Come over at the door. See that spire?
Yes.
That's a church I go to.
Well, what about it?
I like it. I'm a God-fearing man. I want to keep on going there.
Well?
Don't want anybody telling me I have to pray his way.
Well, who'd think of doing that?
It's been done. It's happened often.
You ever hear of state religion?
Yes.
Bad. I don't like it. Don't think we should have it.
Well, we haven't got it.
Nothing in that thing you read me guarantees we won't get it.
For many years, I played an edited for time version of this program in my classes. And I always brought up what seemed to me, what always struck me about this scene with Edward G. Robinson.
Let's see what happens to the Bill of Rights through their 33 administrations, 77 Congresses, and a half a dozen wars. Has anybody anything to say about the status of men's rights December 15th, 1941?
I have something to say, if you don't mind. I'm in jail tonight, but I'm joining in your celebration and cheering as hard as anybody else.
If you don't mind my asking, what...
Well, trumped-up charge. The old routine in the city. But I'm getting out on bail tomorrow, and when I'm finally tried, it'll be by a jury and in public. And none of this Gestapo stuff. Not that they wouldn't try it if they could, but that little 450-word matter you're celebrating tonight stops them short of that.
Yeah, well, what did they check you in the clink for? I mean, what the charge? What...
Making a speech for the fusion party against the mayor. First, we hired a hall. But they took away our permit. Said the building was unsafe under an old fire ordinance. So then we went down to Garrison Square, where no permit is required to speak in public. And within 10 minutes, we were on our way to the police station on charges of blocking traffic, disturbing the peace, and inciting to riot.
Oh, it's a fine thing.
Yes, but listen, we'll beat him. He's scared of us. He's scared the people will find out the truth. And with good reason, because when they do, he's finished. That's why he doesn't want us to be heard.
Uh-huh.
It's only the crooks and the frightened little big shots who need to shut up their opponents. That may work all right in some other countries, but not here.
Yeah, well, how are you going to beat him?
Well, there are such things as rights on our side. And not even the mayor's machine is powerful enough to stop us. We'll fight that fight on every front. Carry it to the highest courts if necessary. And we'll win!
Public trial, habeas corpus. I had a chance to discuss my feelings with Norman in a broadcast interview almost 10 years ago, significantly only 3 months after September 11th, 2001.
After the show was over, one of the most sorrowful periods of time in American history took place when a whole class of people had their rights as citizens, in many cases, violated, the internment of the Japanese.
Oh, yeah. Ironic.
Ironic, exactly.
Yeah.
One of the important factors about the program and about what we were fighting the war for becomes violated by ourselves.
I do not recall that there was any widespread protest. I think that there were individuals who, like yourself, remarked on it, but I don't think there was any movement. There was no big pressure, and I think that's because we were so unaccustomed, the country was so unaccustomed to this kind of situation where the whole world is at war, where American territory had been violated in that perfidious, Roosevelt's term, a day that will live in infamy. They were so stunned by this that they, the judgment, people's judgment was affected. That's the danger of crises, that people will lose track of basics. They will forget the sacredness of the First Amendment, and they will forget the vital importance to all freedom of the Bill of Rights as an entity. Well, we have somewhat of a similar situation right now. When anybody, a Muslim, anybody who's innocent and happens to be, to look like an Arab or come from that part of the world is suspect. And it hasn't reached as graphic and as serious a point yet as it did when we placed all those Japanese in internment camps. But there's a similar problem and a similar issue is being controverted in the press right now and in Congress.
So that we should really be bothered with the fact that that some of these very rights are being violated and people are saying that there's nothing wrong with But no, there's a lot wrong with it, yeah.
As the war progressed, Corwin wrote or directed many programs of series for the war effort. This Is War, An American in England, amongst other such series, with his name in the title, Columbia Presents Corwin. In it, he directed another of Earl Robinson's cantatas, The Lonesome Train, which he also directed for Decca and World Broadcasting Syndication later that night, March 21st, 1944. The recording I use here is the broadcast, not the Decca records. And 13 months later, this would be echoed in the funeral train for FDR.
They tell a story about that train. They say that Lincoln wasn't on that train. When that train started on its trip that day, Lincoln was in Alabama, miles away. Yes, sir, down in Alabama, in an old wooden church, didn't have no paint, didn't have no floor, didn't have no glass in the window. Just a pulpit and some wooden benches. Just a pulpit and some wooden benches. Abe Lincoln on the last bench, away in the back, listening to the sermon, listening to the singing.
This evening, brothers and sisters, yeah, I come in the holiest manner, yeah, to tell how he died.
We know.
The sky turned dark, and seven angels, yeah, leaped over the battlement of glory and come down to get him.
Oh, yeah.
And just when they came near him, he rose.
Oh,
yes, Lord, he rose up and walked down among us. Praise God, he walked back down among his people.
He's living now.
We got a new land. No riding boss with a whip.
No.
Don't have no backbiter.
No.
Liars can't go. Peters can't go. Ain't no devil to chain us. No high sheriff to bring us back.
Down in Alabama, nothing but a pulpit and some wooden benches. And Mr. Lincoln sitting in the back. Away.
Washington to New York, people lined the tracks.
A strange crowd, a quiet crowd, nobody wanting to talk out loud.
At lonely country crossroads, there were farmers and their wives and kids standing around for hours. In Philadelphia, the line of mourners ran 3 miles. And most of them were deep in mourning. An old lady stood by the coffin and said,
Mr. Lincoln, are you dead?
Are you really dead?
At the end, following almost a minute of applause and cheers, the announcer comes in.
You have been listening to The Lonesome Train by Earl Robinson and Corporal Millard Lampel, directed and produced by Norman Corwin for CBS, and starring the distinguished actor Raymond Massey in the role of Lincoln. Earl Robinson himself narrated, and Burl Ives sang the principal role with Richard Huey as the preacher. With Mr. Huey in the church scene were Laura Duncan, Lavinia White, William Veazey, and Charles Alter. The orchestration was by the composer and by Amadeo Di Filippi. Others in the cast were Hester Sondergaard, Lon Clark, Larry Robinson, and Ben Ossipo. Lynn Murray conducted both the orchestra and the Jeff Alexander Choir. Harry Marble speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That's the kind of reaction that also had met Ballad for Americans, which I understand the applause went on for like 15, 20 minutes after they went off the air. But two of Norman's broadcasts at the conclusion of the war have been cited by other broadcast historians as their favorite OTR broadcast. I still prefer We Hold These Truths as an uplifting affirmation of the ideals of our country and society, despite the shameful sidestep of the internment camps. The opening of On a Note of Triumph, first produced on VE Day, repeated a week later and released by Columbia Records. The opening feels a little bit too belligerent, too gloating for me. But I had not gone through 4 years of war with not knowing how much more was still to come.
This day is the father of great anniversaries. Men and saints shall picnic together on 14 August, down more years than you or I shall see. So say it tonight with saluting guns. Say it with roses. Say it with a hand clasp, a drink, a prayer. Say it any way you want, but say it! Say it!
Actually, we've got our tracks. That's my fault that we got our tracks mixed up, because that's the opening of 14 August. But I think what should be coming next, and I'll talk about that afterwards, I think what should be coming next is the beginning of Martin Gable doing On a Note of Triumph.
So they've given up. They're finally done in, and the rat is dead in an alley back of the Wilhelmstrasse. Take a bow, G.I. Take a bow, little guy. The Superman of tomorrow lies dead at the feet of you common men of this afternoon. This is it, kid. This is the day, all the way from Newburyport to Vladivostok. You had what it took, and you gave it. And each of you has a hunk of rainbow around your helmet. Seems like free men have done it again.
By popular request, the Columbia Broadcasting System presents a repeat performance of On a Note of Triumph, a special broadcast written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin for the Day of Victory. Martin Gable is narrator, and the music is by Bernard Herrmann. Martin Gable in Norman Corwin's On a Note of Triumph.
Victory is a sweet dish, or isn't it? And how do you think those lights look in Europe after 5 years of blackout going on to six? Brother, pretty good. Pretty good, sister. The kids of Poland soon will know what an orange tastes like. And the smell of honest-to-God bread, freshly made and sawdust free, will create a stir in the streets of Athens. There's a hot time in the old town of Dniepropetrovsk tonight. And it is reasonable to assume the same goes for 1,000 other cities, including some Scandinavian. It can at last be said without jinxing the campaign, somehow the decadent democracies, the bungling Bolsheviks, the saps and softies, were tougher in the end than the brown shirt bully boys, and smarter too, for without whipping a priest, burning a book, or slugging a Jew, without corralling a girl in a brothel, or bleeding a child for plasma, far-flung ordinary men, unspectacular but free, rousing out of their habits in their homes, got up early one morning, flexed their muscles, learned as amateurs the manual of arms, and set out across perilous plains and oceans to whop the bejeepers out of the professionals. This they did.
But it was not his intent to portray us as militant conquerors. Following an advance reading several months before the broadcast, Norman discussed his feelings about the pending broadcast in a letter. I'm indebted to you to letting me know how the recurrence of the conqueror motif struck you. It's curious that you should have hit upon this because it's already given me considerable concern. Recently, I translated the radio script into a version for print, and this particular device I found embarrassing in its cumulative effect. However, the suspension of the dramatic climb which you experienced at those moments might possibly be absorbed by the musical treatment which has been planned for those very spots. The score has already been composed, and Bernard Herrmann has used a very shrewd device in the music which particularly accents the connotation of the word conqueror. It's a faint wash in the strings with a suggestion of distant taps, remote and half heard. Through such a gentle scrim of music, one would be less likely to see the same terrible outlines as those given to the Colossus in the section on the rise of the Nazis. None of this is to suggest that your point is not well taken. Like so many other things I attempt, the proof always lies in the rehearsal. We must wait to see how it plays, but I'm mindful of what you say, and all the more suspicious of the flaw because your observation is first cousin to my own. As finally broadcast, the main part of the program answers the question of this soft-spoken conqueror, one by one. On the whole, A Note of Triumph is a philosophical analysis of what war, still not over, should mean.
So listen closely. In just a moment now, don't expect to hear metallic speech from a rosette of amplifying horns on the high poles of the public address system. But listen for a modest voice, as sensible and intimate to you as the quiet turning of your own considered judgment. Now we're ready. The voice you hear will be that of the conqueror, the man of the hour, the man of the year, of the past 10 years and the next 20.
I'm a private first class in an army of one of the United Nations. If you don't mind, there's some things I'd like to ask.
Just a man in uniform you've met somewhere or seen in the newsreels, loading a truck, or marching, or read about in the dispatches. A fighting man, glad to be alive, a little tired but in good shape, a dozen battles notched in his gun stock and dug in his memory. Who is he? Well, his name and rank and nationality don't matter much. Just picture him where he may be tonight in Europe. Perhaps in his cot in a barracks, his hands behind his head thinking things over. Perhaps he's standing on a village green before a monument to the dead of World War I. Perhaps he's strolling in a history-weary valley under the same stars which 2,500 years ago watched a Persian brand of Nazi take a beating in the hills of Marathon. Close your eyes, and it could reasonably be this boy, that boy, any boy at all with war still thumping in his ears. Close your eyes and concentrate and listen.
If you don't mind, there's some things we guys would like to ask. first of all, who did we beat?
How much did it cost to beat him? What have we learned? What do we know now that we didn't know before?
What do we do now? Is it all going to happen again?
Can it be? In the interim between the making of a toast and the drinking of it, such questions on the lips of fighting men tonight? Questions from areas of truce, insistent, footnoting the surrender?
Who have we beaten?
Now, the irony is, I mentioned that the CBS, or the Columbia Records set, was of the repeat broadcast. But George Garabedian and Mark 56 had put out the first broadcast from Norman's own file copies on an LP. I've been looking for this thing for years. I found it on Wednesday at Amoeba Records. Now, we had earlier heard this little piece of the beginning of 14 August, and I said I always felt that, you know, Norman's or Orson Welles' reading of the script, you know, went a little bit too far. He shouts, let's say it! And I think that really just a pleading voice like, just say it, would have made more sense. Now, this wasn't part of the script that Charles Kuralt was given 50 years later, but I much prefer for the rest of the script Charles Kuralt's reading of it compared to what Orson did. On 14 August, and then a few days later in an expanded version called God and Uranium, which I only had a chance to hear for the first time about 4 or 5 days ago, and Orson does give that same reading, 5, 6 days later. So I guess that is what Norman would have wanted Orson to read it. Now, following the war, Norman's career took a turn as he accepted the first Wendell Willkie One World Award and undertook a worldwide tour. Most notable for us broadcast recordings historian, CBS sent along an engineer with a wire recorder. And the resulting broadcasts were the first major use of wire recordings, and indeed, major use of recordings on CBS. Also of interest to record collectors is another album that Norman does not like. In 1947, Kate Smith, under the direction of Ted Collins, produced an album on MGM of Between Americans, the script that had been rebroadcast on December 7th, 1941. Now I clutch my copy of it firmly as I read Norman's reply to his agent when he apparently received a royalty check of $1.50 for this album. I'm floored by the NBC, by the MGM dividend. Not the small pickings, but because the fact that the album sold at all. It is such a slovenly botch that I naturally assume no customer with the sense it takes to find a way to a record store would be fool enough to buy the album and bring it home. I wouldn't have it in my house. I burned my copy. Did you ever burn records in a fireplace? It's good sport. Seems like there's a sort of shellac between the laminations of compressed soot or whatever else it is. It goes into the discs. And this burns with a fat, oily, carboniferous flame. Jolly. Records by Ted Collins or featuring the voices of Fulton Lewis or H.V. Kaltenborn seem to make the best fires. So if you ever find that album, you know what he feels about it. Now, in the decades that followed, films, some great films, an apparently lost 1972 TV series. Please, somebody find that series for us. It was done up in Canada, but it was aired in the U.S. on Westinghouse. So, you know, it looks like, from looking at the program list, like it was magnificent. Why can't we find the thing? Oh, and it was Norman Corwin Presents. He also did some radio work, mostly on NPR. I mentioned the Charles Kuralt reading of 14 August plus 50. And some books, and this has kept Norman quite busy. But this takes us beyond the scope of old-time radio. So it's time to take us back to 1945 to witness a recreation of a script originally broadcast live on July 17th, 1945, on Columbia Presents Corwin. Now, my yesterday USA partner, Walden Hughes, will introduce the cast and crew for The Undecided Molecule. Thank you.
Thank you.